Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg is on a stage today at this year's Connect conference, detailing his plan to build a 3D metaverse and maybe even give the company a new name. It's safe to say he's eager to take attention off the blitz of bad press the company's gotten over what are being called the Facebook papers.
We're talking about tens of thousands of internal documents collected by whistleblower Frances Haugen and shared with reporters. They show how Facebook struggled to control misinformation, extremism, and a host of other problems on the platform.
Well, let's dive into what we've been learning about the Facebook papers. And we should note that Facebook is a sponsor of NPR. We're joined by Elizabeth Dwoskin, tech reporter for The Washington Post. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Shira Frankel, tech reporter for The New York Times and co-author of the book An Ugly Truth. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
These documents reveal a lot about how much the company knew about certain problems and its efforts to address them. Elizabeth, what stands out to you?
Well, a lot of people, including the whistleblower herself, have made this analogy to the big tobacco moment for Facebook. And I think something about that is very apt in that they knew sometimes for years about the extent to which their platforms caused polarization, hate speech, harm to the mental health of young people. And it was all being called out by very earnest employees that were trying to bring attention to it.
Yeah. Shira, your reporting also focuses on how employees of Facebook repeatedly raised these red flags about the spread of misinformation. What stands out to you most?
Just the amount of resources that Facebook dedicated to really figuring out what was happening with misinformation, hate speech, and conspiracies on their platforms is really amazing. That they didn't listen to what those employees brought to light, I think, is where the issue lies. But I do think that as a reporter, I was really fascinated by how much time they spent researching all of this.
And Shira, let me stay with you here. A lot of the problems stem from Facebook's newsfeed system, and it was found to elevate toxic and polarizing comments and other content on, say, the run-up to January 6th, lies about vaccines, and in the India market, anti-Muslim hate. What did Facebook know about the damage its newsfeed system can do?
It knew quite a bit. I mean, in some of the most interesting experiments, one of their researchers did this thing where she basically launched a new account as a Facebook user, and she placed herself in India, or she placed herself in the middle of America as a Christian mom, and she just waited to see where Facebook's algorithms were going to push her. And what she found in these experiments was that very quickly, usually within a matter of 2 or 3 weeks, she was being pushed towards the most hateful, extreme, and sometimes violent content on the platform by its own algorithms. And so I think, you know, she was raising the alarms very early on, along with many other members of the research and data team, to say, our algorithms are the problem. We're pushing people into these groups that then seed misinformation or spread a conspiracy. And so it's not about necessarily people seeking this out themselves. It's where we as a company are pushing them.
Yeah. And Elizabeth, tell us a little bit more about what we know about this algorithm and how it, you know, seems to push up the most toxic comments and other stuff.
Yeah, I thought that was one of the most fascinating parts of the Facebook papers. And, you know, both Shira and I have covered the company for a long time. So, you know, but I still found it completely eye-opening because you can actually see all the equations for their algorithms, like how they weight different things. One of the examples that I thought was amazing was, you know, they weight emoji reactions more strongly than just a like. And for years, though, they were overweighting the angry emoji. And you know, initially it makes sense. Emojis are a stronger expression of emotion. But then, you know, there were researchers and data scientists who said, look, when we put this weight on the angry emoji, we can actually see that we're driving people to things that make them angry. We're driving them to divisive content. We're driving them to misinformation. And there were years of debates about that, changing the emoji, changing the reshare system. And what you can see over and over, even though the documents are just a point in time, is the way in which you felt like these researchers were just kind of calling out into this echo chamber, like they weren't being listened to. I think about the Washington Post or place I worked. If someone knew that their service was doing something this terrible, would they have waited this long to take action? And that's just one of so many examples in the documents.
Right. I mean, one of the more consequential fallouts of this kind of misinformation has to do with the presidential election. Shira, you did a lot of reporting back in 2016 about the spread of lies and misinformation on the platform. And the company spoke very publicly back then about the ways that they were going to fight this misinformation. Was this just talk? I mean, were they as prepared as they said they would be for the flood of falsehoods and divisive content that we saw during the 2020 election?
I mean, it wasn't just talk in the sense that Mark Zuckerberg decided he wanted to weigh things differently on the newsfeed. He made this announcement internally in the company and eventually externally that he wanted more weight given to something he called meaningful social interactions. Now, that's a very broad term, and I remember as a reporter being confused when I first heard it, because how do you determine what's meaningful? But he essentially said that he wanted posts from people's families and friends to be weighted more heavily, and he wanted certain types of content like those by news organizations maybe not placed as heavily because he thought people were not as interested in them, and some news organizations may not be fact-checking as much as others. But the downward consequences of all this is it actually made misinformation worse. The changes, a lot of the changes that Facebook implemented in the wake of 2016 actually contributed to misinformation. Yes, the Macedonian news sites that were spreading blatant falsehoods in 2016 were not featured as prominently on the newsfeed. Many of them were taken off the platform entirely. But others emerged, and Americans shared with one another posts that were just full of conspiracies, full of falsehoods.
Elizabeth, let me ask you a little bit more about Facebook overseas. The government of India wants answers from Facebook about pushing inflammatory content in markets like India and elsewhere. What did Facebook know about its algorithm there, and whether the company could control what happened?
Well, there were some like astonishing numbers in the documents that really showed the degree to which Facebook overly focuses on the U.S. And, you know, a number of news organizations put this headline in their stories. We did too, which was just, if you think things are bad in the U.S. on Facebook, just look at the rest of the world. And what you see in the documents is how under-resourced they were in the places where the vast majority of their users live. There were lots of data points in the story in Afghanistan and India where they didn't support some of the languages. There's ethnic violence, and they just didn't even have content moderators or hate speech algorithms, hate speech detection algorithms that can pick up slurs and other harmful words and phrases. They didn't even have them in certain languages where ethnic violence was taking place. I saw this great document where basically they had content moderators who spoke Arabic in Morocco, and they wanted to know whether the moderators were proficient in many, many dialogues of Arabic that are all around the Arabic-speaking world. And they asked the moderators, they basically, do you think you're proficient in all these types of Arabic? And the moderators thought they were. And then they went back and audited it, and they found that the moderators couldn't moderate in those dialects. So there were just so many examples that really showed me, okay, when you see Facebook getting blamed, or we've written stories about these surges of ethnic conflict that have been fueled by misinformation on Facebook or WhatsApp, I mean, you can just see behind the scenes how under-equipped they were and how under-invested they were. And, you know, this is a company that has probably invested more billions of dollars in safety and security and these resources than any other service. So what does that say about the capacity to self-police?
Right. Well, I mean, that is the big question. Is this problem too big to fix for Facebook? And we'll start with you, Shira.
It might be too big to fix right now because the sheer breadth of it seems overwhelming. Facebook is all over the world with billions of users, thousands of different languages. But I think that if you parse it out to one country at a time, one issue at a time, you start to see a way forward. So in India, which Liz was just talking about, yes, Facebook had a serious problem. They really, you know, aggressively entered that market and then only developed the ability to moderate content in 4 of the 22 languages that are spoken there. So you can see a path forward in which Facebook really invests heavily in the other languages and in in-country moderation teams. But it's really parsed out, I think, country by country. And I think if Facebook had developed the same amount of resources to making sure that its applications, its platform, were being safely used in these countries as it did to aggressively pushing into the market, we wouldn't be seeing the problems that we were having today.
Liz.
I'm not as optimistic as Shira. I think that, yes, it is true that if they heavily, heavily invest in a market, they can prevent some problems. But we know they've also heavily invested in the United States more than anywhere else And we saw massive problems also with their policies that exempted powerful people from their rules. There's also, like, very deeply in the DNA in the company, and it comes from Zuckerberg, is this belief in free speech and this belief that we should be more hands-off with content than hands-on. We shouldn't micromanage content. So you're also coming up against core philosophies of this company. So you have this free speech ethos, you have this corporate and Facebookian need to grow. And I also think there's something to the fact that even when they have tried to put in measures to mitigate these problems, often tons of stuff slips through the cracks. So the algorithm is actually, like, more powerful than them in many cases.
All right, we got to leave it there. Elizabeth Dwoskin is technology reporter for The Washington Post, and Shira Frankel is technology reporter for The New York Times. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.